Okay. Thanks for having me here. I'm Chris Harada, and I'll be telling you about the recombination epoch, the epoch 300,000 years after the Big Bang, when the universe transitioned from ionized to neutral. Before I begin, I'd like to thank my collaborators, Eric Switzer, who worked with me at Princeton on the recombination of helium, Dan Grind, who's a graduate student at Caltech, John Forbes is an undergraduate, and Yassine Ali Hamoud is a grad student at Caltech in his fourth year, and will be on the market next year. And Espandier Alizadeh is a graduate student at Illinois who spends more than half of his time at Caltech and is working with us. The general picture during the talk, first I'll try to motivate for you why we care about the recombination epoch, in particular, given that it's just atomic physics and radiative transfer, what this has to do with fundamental physics as well. I'll spend a lot of time talking about the standard picture of how the universe recombined. That will be almost a third of the talk. I figure if I'm going to tell you about corrections to something, I should tell you, corrections to what. Then I'll go over how we do precise calculations of the recombination history of the early universe, what neat new physical effects come into play that are all, in some sense, conventional physics, but they're things that we don't usually worry about in astronomy. Then I'll go over how we can test this picture and see that we did all of these calculations correctly. So the context first. So here is a highly oversimplified picture of the evolution of the universe. Some very early epoch, the initial perturbations in the universe were laid down, possibly during an epoch of inflation. Since this is not a NASA view graph, I don't have a picture of it yet. The universe subsequently expanded and cooled, a few minutes after the Big Bang, we had Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the formation of the light elements. As the universe continued to expand and cool, at some point, the temperature dropped low enough, around a few tenths of an EV, that atoms could form. That's critical for us, because one of our key methods of understanding the early universe is to look at the cosmic microwave background. And when you look at the cosmic microwave background, this is what you're seeing, because the earlier universe had all these free electrons running around, and they make the universe opaque to constant scattering. But the neutral atoms are transparent, at least to microwaves and infrared and so on. So that's really what you're seeing, and that's why the recombination epoch will play so centrally in our attempts to do precision cosmology and learn particularly about inflation from that. As we move to lower redshifts, later times, the universe continued to expand and cool, but it also became lumpier because of gravitational instability. At some fairly recent epoch, the expansion of the universe even began to accelerate. At places like Perimeter, the major interests are often here and here with the dark energy. But as I'll explain, in order to probe those with the microwave background, we need to understand this. So there are the microwave background anisotropies. This is an image from the WMAP satellite. The red stuff is the galaxy. Yassine has worked with me on galactic emission, but that's the subject of another talk. You'll see the mean temperature of the microwave background is about 3 kelvins, at least it is now. And you see all of these small perturbations. Those are, for the most part, density and velocity perturbations at the surface of last scattering, redshifts of 1,000, where the cosmic microwave background photons started just streaming towards us, or the ones we see were streaming towards us. And the anisotropies in the microwave background, we typically describe with this thing called power spectrum. So you take the spherical harmonic transform of the microwave sky, and you ask how much variance is there in each of those multipole moments. And you get one of these spectra like this. What you see here are the very large angular scales show up at the left side of the plot. These are perturbations in the universe that were outside the horizon at the time of recombination, and with some exceptions, there you're just seeing unprocessed stuff that came out of the early universe, out of inflation or whatever alternative. There's this series of acoustic peaks, which are oscillations in the baryon photon plasma between the basically between when these scales re-entered the cosmic horizon and the time of recombination. Finally, at the very smallest angular scales, this is what we call the damping tail region. These are fluctuations that have been suppressed because the photons have actually diffused prior to the recombination epoch, because the opacity of the universe is not infinite. The photons can move some distance. If you didn't have that diffusion effect, these multipoles would be up at about 25,000. So diffusion is a big deal. What do we learn from that plot? Well, in addition to learning about the baryon and dark matter content of the universe, which would be a subject for another talk, we also learn about the primordial and homogeneities. So the density perturbations, or we call them scalar perturbations because of their symmetry, have some spectrum of fluctuations, some contribution to their variance that depends on scale. And what's critical here is this, what we call the spectral index, NS. NS is really the key to understanding where these perturbations come from, or one of the keys. In particular, I think the most widely studied candidate, most widely studied way to generate those initial density perturbations is from inflation, where you have the standard picture, there are many variations on this. But you have some nearly exponential period of expansion. There's some new field that provides the energy density to make the universe accelerate. If this expansion were truly exponential, if it were truly scale invariant, each e-fold of expansion is like the previous one, then you would get out a power spectrum that's close to the scale invariant. That is, NS equals 1, so this doesn't depend on K. It's not quite true. Inflation has to end, and if inflation proceeds for about 50 or 60 e-folds after the scales leave their microwave background left the horizon, then you might expect NS minus 1 to deviate from 0 by, you know, 1 over 50 or something of that order. As you'll see on the next slide, that may even have been seen. You can get a variety of different models, and they populate this nice plane. If you go to cosmic microwave background conferences, you see a lot of plots like this, where on the horizontal axis, the scalar spectral index is plotted. One is perfectly scale invariant. And the vertical axis here is the amount of primordial gravitational waves. And you see just a few inflationary models are plotted here. There are some that you can put in different positions. The curves here are the regions allowed by the doubling map data in this case. As you can see, measuring this at the level of a couple percent is really critical to start distinguishing some of these models. In particular, that's the only reason that lambda phi to the fourth theory appears to not be doing so well. I told you we're trying to measure the primordial spectrum. And of course, changing the index of the primordial spectrum will change the index of the spectrum that you're seeing here in the microwave background. If I increase the spectral index, then all of my small scales move up. That's, just what spectral indices do. And on the other hand, it moves down. But, and this is the motivation for the rest of the talk, there are other things that affect that part of the microwave background spectrum. In particular, cosmic recombination. So here's a plot of the cosmic recombination history as we conventionally understand it. This is a paper by Sarah Seeger and company about a decade ago. I'll show you a lot of these plots. So they show the redshift on the horizontal axis. So time moves to the left. My apologies. The vertical axis is the ionization fraction. And because this field was populated initially by astronomers who borrowed physics of the interstellar medium, ionization fraction means the number of free electrons divided by the number of hydrogen nuclei. So if the universe is completely neutral, that's zero. If the hydrogen in the universe is completely ionized, that's one. And there are 0.08 helium atoms in the universe for every hydrogen. So if I ionize the helium as well, then this ionization fraction could be above one. And if I doubly ionize the helium, it could be 1.16. Such is convention. I'm not going to try to change it. That would be even worse. You can see here, as the universe cools off, helium has a higher ionization energy than hydrogen. Both of its ionization energies are higher. This point down here is where the optical depth is 1. That's, roughly speaking, what you see when you look at the microwave background sky. That's what we call surface blast scattering. This region in here is optically thick. You don't actually see it directly. But it's still important because, remember, during this epoch, the photons are still diffusing, or they're starting to diffuse. And if you have faster recombination, if you have fewer electrons here, then the photon mean free path and diffusion length and so on will go up. And all of the small scale features in the microwave background, these guys, will go down. As far as the temperature anisotropies are concerned, that looks just like changing in S. So we really need to get that right. This point was driven home to us a few years ago, this paper by Anthony Lewis and company, they've created mock data sets for the Planck satellite and analyzed them. The blue and magenta contours describe two different versions of the recombination history that were floating around in the literature at that time. You can see here for NS a rather embarrassing shift of several sigmas in the scalar spectral index. If this is the correct one, we don't want to be getting that. And this is theta. This is the angular. This is basically a measurement of the acoustic sound horizon at the surface of blast scattering. This is the measurement that goes into everyone's calculations for dark energy. When you see pretty much any dark energy measurement these days, it's the doubly mapped satellite plus supernovas or baryon oscillations or something else. And in a few years, it will be the Planck satellite plus those other things. And this measurement really underlies all of the tests of, for example, whether W is different from minus one. So I think really figuring out what is the correct calculation here is critical, given that between inflation and dark energy, we've covered two of the three major puzzles in cosmology today.
How recombination enters the angular diameter distance?
I
think that would just be the location of the first peak. So where does recombination come into that?
So this is a it's a measurement. So this is actually the angle, it's not horizon divided by distance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's actually the observable quantity.
Mm-hmm.
If you change the sound horizon by making the universe redefined a little earlier or later, then can you change that? Okay, so the objective for the rest of the talk is that we're going to try to provide very precise theoretical
computations of the recombination history of the universe. And we want the accuracy of those calculations to be sufficient for particularly the Planck satellite launched last year. But if you can do that properly also for the other microwave background experiments as well. I focused on Planck because it's the highest precision of the things we're getting soon.
Okay, so standard picture
of how recombination works. Well, the simplest photoionized region, or in astronomy speak, H2 region, in the universe. It's by astronomical standards, trivial. It's homogeneous and isotropic, with perturbations that start at a few times 10 to the minus 5 and grow to maybe 10 to the minus 4. During this high redshift epoch. The expansion history comes out of the Friedmann equation, so there's no complicated hydrodynamics, at least in the simplest picture. The composition is simple. You've got hydrogen and helium. You might want to worry about some of the weird isotopes, and the lithium, it turns out, doesn't do anything as far as this talk is concerned. But in particular, there's no opportunity to produce dust or solids or things with nasty unknown optical properties. The radiation field, instead of being something that comes out of stellar atmosphere like you would have in nebular physics, is just a black body. We've all seen the beautiful FIRAS curves, and both from theory and from observation, that's what the universe started with. So this ought to be simple. And so the first thing that you could write down, which was written down in the early 60s, is to try to model the early universe with the Saha equation, the equation describing the ionization equilibrium of the gas. That tells you, if you just write down that equation, that about half of the hydrogen should recombine by redshift 1370, and 90% by redshift 1250. Thereafter, because you get this nice exponential term, R is the Rydberg in frequency units, because you have this exponential term that comes out of the usual Boltzmann argument, thereafter, the rest of the hydrogen recombines really, really fast. The problem is that the real universe is not described by equilibrium thermodynamics. Even though if you do the usual calculation of recombination timescales, you take a rate coefficient times a density, that's fast. Instead, something more complicated happens. So let's take a look at that. And the first calculations of this were the ones by Jim Peebles and by Zaldovich et al. So what they did was they studied this period, the hydrogen period. They asked, well, what's the process? Well, what are the reaction kinetics? What actual pathways are there for the hydrogen to recombine? And the first one you might think of is a proton and an electron find each other. and they give you a hydrogen atom, and they release some energy in the process that comes off as a photon. Well, the problem with this is that, as it had been recognized by interstellar medium astronomers since, I think, the 20s or 30s, was that this photon has an energy greater than the ionization energy of hydrogen. So it's just going to go ionize another hydrogen atom, and you can calculate the net reaction there, and it doesn't really do very much. If you want to actually give net production of hydrogen, instead what you have to do is go to an excited state of hydrogen first. And this photon has low energy. It can't ionize anything. And then that hydrogen atom has to decay and emit a series of photons. And no individual one of those photons has enough energy to ionize hydrogen atom. So that's good. And it even has a name. It's called phenomenon is called case B. That's good, except that there's one more complication, which is that this process is taking place inside of a black body, the CMB, which at this time had a temperature of 3,000 kelvins. What happens when you're in a black body? Well, you then have two steps to recombination. To recombine, you not only need a proton and electron to find each other and give you an excited hydrogen atom, that hydrogen atom has to make its way down to the ground state before it gets ionized again by the microwave background. So if you draw the sort of diagram, you can, you know, the pathways go both up and down. If you look at the second stage here in this pathway, you can get a hydrogen atom that's excited to get down to the ground state, either by emitting a Lyman alpha photon. And of course, those are in a spectral line of hydrogen. They can get reabsorbed. And maybe eventually they escape by, you know, they redshift out of the line. You are, after all, in an expanding universe. Or if you're in the 2s state of hydrogen, you can get what we call a two-photon decay. There's no dipole moment for a one-photon decay, but you can emit two photons simultaneously. And once again, all of these processes have inverse reactions. I'll reiterate what Annika said yesterday about dark matter in the solar system. Anytime you do a calculation, you should include the inverse reaction, and this is no exception. In principle, and when we actually do this calculation, we actually follow all of the excited levels of hydrogen. But the original analyses, limited by the computational power available in the 1960s, lumped them all together, treated them as being in Boltzmann equilibrium, which is not that far off. So the next few slides will have lots of equations, but that will not scare people here. What I'm going to do is go through this diagram, which is a qualitative picture, and just try to show you quantitatively how the recombination of hydrogen comes about, how you calculate its rate.
Reaction like absorption of two photons should be very small. It is usually very rarefied.
It would, in the vast majority of cases, it's very small. But the one exception is if you have something and something similar to a black body. Because if I give you a black body and I ask you what's the probability of 10 eV photon, right? That's e to the minus e over kT. If I ask what's the probability to have 2.5 eV photons, that's e to the minus e1 over kT times e to the minus e2 over kT. And because you add the exponents when you multiply the exponentials, the probability is actually not suppressed.
So it's a very weird situation. So in the process I showed you earlier, the first step is to take protons and electrons and make excited hydrogen atoms.
Less space price density for the lower energy photon.
There's less phase space, but not by a huge factor. Okay. So feel free to interrupt.
So the first step in the diagram I showed you is to produce excited hydrogen atoms, which I'll label H star here. And the rate at which you produce them by recombinations is a rate coefficient. There's the product of the electron and proton densities. And because these densities, these X's, are normalized to the number of hydrogen atoms, there's actually a density here. Right? I could have an N dot here and an NE and P and cancel one of the hydrogen densities. So this merely tells you that at twice the density, a given proton has twice the probability to find an electron. Alpha B, you can compute, it's of order 10 to the minus 13 centimeters cubed per second. There's a reverse reaction, which is that you can photoionize excited hydrogen atoms, and you calculate the reverse reaction by the principle of detailed balance, where you take your rate coefficient, and you have the product of the reactant abundances, and you subtract a term that's proportional to the amount of product. That's how you get a reverse reaction rate. And you put whatever factors are required here so that the net rate is zero in thermal equilibrium. By this method, you can get an equation for how many excited hydrogen atoms you're producing. What you'll notice is that if you're in thermal equilibrium, this is zero. That's by construction, and that's good. I've stuffed in here the partition function for the excited hydrogen atoms. That's just because if there are more available states, then you should have more of these guys in equilibrium. That's all usual thermodynamics. The second step is to get these hydrogen atoms down to the ground state. And there are two ways to do that that I mentioned, the two-photon process and the Lyman alpha decays. The two-photon process, the rate at which I have atoms that are de-exciting, I can simply write as a rate coefficient times the abundance of the excited state. And the rate coefficient is 8 inverse seconds. And that's kind of amazing for atomic physics. The excited hydrogen atom in the 2s state in vacuum lives an eighth of a second. It's a long time. Still short compared to the age of the universe, but a long time by atomic standards. Of course, once again, we need the reverse reaction. Sorry to sound like a broken record, but half of my terms are reverse reactions. I can correct this downward rate by putting in an upward rate. 3/4 of a Rydberg is simply the energy difference between the first and second states of hydrogen. And if I go with this assumption that the excited levels of hydrogen are in Boltzmann equilibrium, I can replace the abundance of hydrogens in 2s with the abundance of excited hydrogens by their contribution to the partition function. Okay, so I've given you the equations for two of the arrows on my plot. Now for the third one, which is Lyman alpha, and that's the most complicated. It's the most complicated because it's a radiative transfer problem. The Lyman alpha line has an optical depth of a few hundred million during recombination. So almost every photon that gets emitted in that line gets immediately reabsorbed. And I kick the hydrogen atom back up to the 2p state. That results in an equilibrium developing between the decays and the excitations, such that the decay rate, so A here is the Einstein coefficient, the natural decay rate for 2p, it's something, the lifetime is 1.6 nanoseconds. So that decay rate gets balanced by the absorption rate, which is proportional to the phase space density of Lyman alpha photons and the number of atoms available to absorb them. So this by some algebra, I can then obtain the phase space density of those Lyman alpha photons, and it's related to the ratio of excited to de-excited hydrogen atoms, which you might expect. Now, in order to get a net reaction, I have to remove the Lyman alpha photons somehow. And then, in accordance with Wachat-Liès principle, if I take away some of this, then the reaction will shift to the right. And in traditional interstellar medium physics, you learn that Lyman alpha photons can get absorbed by dust grains, they can get absorbed by ionizing metal atoms. They can fly out of your nebula and go off into empty space. None of those options are available in the early universe. There are no metals. And so far as I know, even in string theory, it's not possible at any significant rate for these photons to jump onto the other brain. But the good news, if you want this reaction to go, is that the universe is expanding. So you can take these Lyman alpha photons and redshift them out of the line, and that gets rid of them. So here's a diagram of photons redshifting out of a line. So I've shown the phase space density as a function of frequency, and all photons in this diagram march to the left. Here's the Lyman alpha line. On the blue side of the line, I have a black body because those photons have not interacted with the atoms yet. That's actually not quite true, and I'll correct that statement later, but only by an order of magnitude. On the red side of the line, you have all the photons that have redshifted out of the line, so you've got a little step. And this region is almost flat because of Liouville's theorem. Once a photon has redshifted out of the line, the phase space density that it sees is constant, so long as there's no source or sink term. What I could do is I could equate the step across this line to the rate of, I can do two things. One is I could say that the photons redshifting out of the line were in equilibrium when they were actually at the Lyman alpha frequency. So I can take the formula from the previous slide. Alternatively, I could say that the rate at which Lyman alpha photons are being emitted is equal to the step size times the rate at which photon modes redshift through the line. Right? It's the usual phenomenon. You know, if I have a conveyor belt moving to the left here, and I have the top half of an hourglass, I'm depositing sand, then I can calculate the rate at which sand is getting deposited by taking the size of the step and multiplying by the velocity. Same business here. And if I go back to my usual mode counting arguments, then I can get the net decay rate of atoms via the Lyman alpha line. And I equate it to various factors times the step. So there you have it. I've gone through the calculation of all of these processes. There's the recombination process to give you excited hydrogen atoms. There's a decay process to get those atoms down to the ground state. We've got the formulas for both. Because photons stay in an excited state for only a short amount of time, we can equate these two rates, just like you equate the currents going through two resistors placed in series. That enables one to eliminate the abundance of excited hydrogen atoms from the equation. Just like given two resistors in series, you can eliminate the voltage at their junction. So you go ahead and you do that, and you get this horrible-looking ordinary differential equation for the rate at which the universe recombines. So there's a recombination rate, It's horrible looking, but each term makes sense. There's a rate coefficient to get the electrons and protons to recombine. There's a branching fraction for how many of those recombined atoms go down to the ground state instead of going back up and getting reionized. So there's 2 photon decay plus Lyman alpha over 2 photon decay plus Lyman alpha plus ionization. There's a density of reactants, and there's an inverse term. So that is the standard cosmic recombination model. And you can do a whole bunch of things to it. You can add bells and whistles, which is what the subject did for 30 years. You can put in helium. I won't do all of those equations for helium, but the physics is the same. You can start resolving the excited levels of the hydrogen atom in proportion to how much computing power you've got. You can put in collisions, collisional transitions between hydrogen levels. They don't do very much, but you can put them in. You can put in stimulated recombinations, where the recombination photon is stimulated by the CMB. You can start following the temperature of the gas separately from the radiation. I showed you Lyman alpha. You can do Lyman beta and Lyman gamma and so on. And all of these things have been done over the years. And the problem was, we thought, solved.
There was a radiative transfer aspect to the Lyman alpha. But where did that, how did that get into your
equation? The only part where it comes into that equation in this oversimplified picture, which I'm about to tell you needs to be corrected, is that in this step here, I said you reach an equilibrium between emission and absorption of photons. Instead of just saying I'm going to take the decay rate and multiply by the number of excited atoms. So I've taken account of absorption, that's why I made radiative transfer. But I'll make the radiative transfer a lot more complicated in a few slides. Hopefully also more accurate. Okay.
So I got interested in doing precision calculations of this about 5 years ago. And before that, it wasn't really on my radar screen. In fact, situation was that as a beginning graduate student at Princeton, like all good graduate students in cosmology, I read Little and Light. Excellent book. If you're interested in inflation and perturbation theory and so on. But one of the things they told us in the introduction was they said, they talk about cosmology, and they say, fortunately, to work in these research areas, it is not necessary to understand fully their complexity, that is, these calculations, because there exist fitting functions in publicly available computer programs that can carry out these tasks. These can be treated as a black box. You feed in the input, and out comes the desired answer.
Ending.
Well, it's dangerous to tell people stuff like that because they believe it, and they take it too seriously. But fortunately, the folks at St. Petersburg did not. And 2005, the St. Petersburg group wrote a paper telling us that we had errors of several percent and that we needed to go back and look at this. So let's look at what they had to say. Well,
I drew this diagram where excited hydrogen atoms can sit in the 2s state and simultaneously emit 2 photons and go down to the ground state. However, because you're in this thermal microwave background field, you'll have some atoms up in the third shell as well. And the selection rules allow two photon decays from either 3s or 3d. And the number of atoms in 3d is not all that small. If you take Boltzmann seriously, it's the percent of 2s. And so you might think at the percent level, two photon decays from 3d give you a correction for the recombination history. So what about this process? The St. Petersburg group didn't actually calculate that rate. They did an order of magnitude calculation. I thought I would do this calculation more carefully. And I found out to my surprise that the answer was not given by their order of magnitude calculation, but instead was infinite. So, the order of magnitude, right, is just the factor of order unity is infinite. So what happens is, you might think you just replace the rate, you might think you add in this additional rate coefficient into your equations, and you can go back and calculate the rate coefficient. It's a two-photon decay. We've known since the work of Gotthard Meyer 80 years ago how to do two-photon calculations. There are some phase space factors. There are transition matrix elements. You sum over all of them. You square them. You integrate over final states. Right. That's what we're taught how to do. And if you do this for the 2s state, you get something like this. This is actually the differential rate as a function of frequency. This is the frequency in units of Rydbergs. So 0.75, or 3/4, is the endpoint, the maximum amount of energy you can release. So that's when one photon has all the energy. And 3/8 is when the two photons have equal energy. You split the decay energy equally between the two photons. And this is that rate. The vacuum curve is here. And these higher curves correspond to higher temperatures where you can get stimulated decays. You can see this thing is well behaved. I can integrate that. So why don't we try the same thing for 3D? So there's the curve for 3D. And the first thing you'll notice is that I put it on a log scale. Now, my observational colleagues put things on log scales to hide the fact that their error bars are huge. But infinity is an embarrassment even on log scale. The infinity arises from the fact that there's a resonance where I get sequential emission of a photon in a one spectral line of hydrogen and then the Lyman alpha line. And in fact, the standard two photon decay formula is actually giving you, it's interesting, it's giving you the correct damping wings of these lines. And then as you get far, far away from resonance, you get other corrections because there are other intermediate states that are important. But how do we handle this? What's the practical thing to do? Well, we had a raging debate in the literature for several years over what to do about this. There were a whole bunch of suggestions about, why don't we just trap out certain intermediate states? It turns out that's not a good idea. It's not gauge invariant, and it has other problems as well. You don't just remove terms you don't like. People understood that there were problems, so there was a lot of confusion. But the way we eventually solved it was we realized that what was really going on was that this is a radiative transfer issue. The problem is that these photons that have a huge production rate here, these photons immediately get reabsorbed, and these photons don't. So we need a treatment that follows what happens with all of these photons that actually tracks them as they get emitted and then later absorbed. And really, there are two separate regimes there. So you can think about photons with energies below Lyman alpha or above Lyman alpha. So for the energies below Lyman alpha, your production mechanisms are things like this, where you get two photon decays. And because you have photons at energies slightly less than Lyman alpha, less than 10.2 eV, you can actually absorb photons that have redshifted out of the Lyman alpha line. You can absorb them into photon absorption. So you've got one problem there. If you work between Lyman alpha and Lyman beta, you have the opposite problem. You can produce photons that are at energies greater than the Lyman alpha energy, either by two photon decay or by Raman scattering from the 2s level of hydrogen, where the excited hydrogen atom dumps its energy into a C and B photon that, you know, gets moved out to the ultraviolet. And then those photons get absorbed. And the farther they are from the Lyman alpha resonance, the longer it is before they get reabsorbed. So it's interesting. Photons that are farther from resonance are produced less often, but they matter more per photon. So here's what that does to the recombination history. This is the third code I wrote to try to solve this. The first two crashed, delivering me a course in computational physics that I never took in graduate school. So here's this is delta XE over XE, a fractional change in the number of electrons, and scale here is a percent. As a function of redshift. And what's happened is that the high redshifts, recombination has gone very rapidly, or it's sped up, because I have new ways of getting atoms to the ground state. But then, since I have all of those photons that are redshifting into Lyman alpha at low redshift, I start exciting atoms, they get ionized, recombination slows down, and recombination slowing down means more free electrons. If I look at what that's doing to the distribution of photons, so this is the phase-space density of photons as a function of frequency. So if you took an ultraviolet spectrograph and put it in the universe 300,000 years after the Big Bang, this is what you would get. This is the C and B blackbody curve. The dashed curve here is what you would get without the corrections I was mentioning. Without the two photon decay corrections. And you see these actual steps of the Lyman lines, similar to the cartoon I showed you earlier, except this came out of a computer. These are the standard Peebles type steps.
Smooth.
So in principle, they should be smooth as the width of the line.
Right.
And
Peebles formula is the width of the line dimension.
It's a delta function.
It's a delta.
So
it does really produce steps.
Yeah. So you get a discontinuous jump in that approximation, in the spectrum of photons. Mm-hmm. And a similar, but as you can see, much less important one at the higher Lyman lines. And then the solid curve here is what you get when you do the two photon decays, the Raman scattering. And I also included direct two photon recombinations. And there you see this much smoother curve. You see the damping wing of Lyman alpha, blue damping wing. This step is smooth to scale smaller than one pixel on a computer screen. As you go to lower redshift, the effect gets much larger. So you've got a huge number of photons basically sitting here. And those are the photons that at low redshift are going to move into Lyman alpha. Here's what it does to the microwave background. Yes.
Just back on your debate and so on. You explained away this infinite decay rate by inverse processes, basically.
Yes.
But what if the atom was just in isolation. Are you saying that we really have an infinite decay rate?
So the decay rate is finite because the intermediate state has a finite lifetime. So the propagator hole for the an electron in a Coulomb field gets displaced slightly off the real axis. So when you do the integral over emitted frequencies, you get a finite result.
What is the unstable intermediate state?
So it's in a frequency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So the process. Right. The process is that.
Okay.
And the state has a finite lifetime. So instead of this, right, something like that.
So that was actually slightly a rhetorical flourish to say that it was infinite.
At tree level, it's infinite.
Okay.
But you're right. And if you did the full calculation, you would have an infinite result. So
wait a second. The full calculation there does not look like a transport problem.
No,
in other words, what resolves the singularity for an isolated atom is different than what resolves it in a plasma. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Huh. In an optically thick surrounding medium. The
gamma term is irrelevant.
Right. You get cut off much farther from the pole by reabsorption effects. Okay. There's the effect on the microwave background power spectra. So this is a function of multipole again. Power spectra come down because in that early epoch where I have fewer free electrons, I get more photon diffusion. And the dashed line here is an analytic approximation that I cooked up just to make sure that what was coming out of my computer makes sense. And the bottom panel here shows the change in polarization power spectrum. And what you'll notice is that the polarization to temperature ratio is increased. And I'll get back to that later. That's a good thing because it means that one can distinguish this effect that I'm telling you about in the two photon decays from what you would get simply by changing NS, at least in principle. And the correction mostly the temperature power spectrum is 7 sigma for the Planck satellite.
Just for the temperature, 7 sigma.
The polarization contributes a tiny amount to that. They both round to 7 sigma, but one of them is like 6.5 something, and the other is 6.9 something. So the temperature has much higher signal to noise. Another thing I wanted to mention is I had an undergraduate work on this, was the diffusion of photons of the Lyman alpha line. So we have this picture of Lyman alpha scattering, where a hydrogen atom absorbs the photon, passes through some intermediate state, and re-emits the photon. If I treat the hydrogen atom as being completely at rest, the photon's energy doesn't change. But in a real plasma with the hydrogen atoms moving around, the photon picks up a little Doppler kick because it's scattering off of the moving atom. So this leads to a certain amount of diffusion of photons near the Lyman alpha line. It smears the Lyman alpha line out. At Caltech, we can get undergraduates to solve these problems. So I got John Forbes to write a module that we plugged into my earlier code. Actually, writing the new module to do the Lyman alpha calculations was easy. Getting the interface to work was hard. And so there's a correction here to the recombination history that's smaller than what I showed you for two photon decays, and it occurs at later times. Nevertheless, it's there. And I can tell you afterwards why the analytic approximation we hooked up doesn't seem to work very well. I think we understand that. But the bottom line here is that the additional fusion term is allowing you to move photons out of the damping wing supplied in alpha, in particular the red damping wing where they escape more easily, and so you recombine faster. I should mention helium, since this was Eric Switzer's thesis. So on this plot, I've shown the ionization fraction in the time period between which helium goes from singly ionized down to neutral. And this curve here is the thermal equilibrium prediction. As you can see, none of the more detailed calculations look anything like it. This was the old calculation by Sarah Seeger and company. And Eric's calculation actually produces a faster helium recombination. And the reason is another radiative transfer effect. It's that
helium, when helium decays to the ground state, it's emitting these far ultraviolet photons. The wavelength of the strongest line of helium is 584 angstroms. That photon is at sufficiently short wavelengths that it can ionize a neutral hydrogen atom. So as soon as you get even a tiny amount of neutral hydrogen, you know, part per million or something like that, the hydrogen can start absorbing helium resonance line photons. A huge amount of energy goes into this electron, which it dissipates through Coulomb collisions. And thereby, you get essentially a sink for helium resonance line photons and a dramatic speed up of helium recombination. And the final calculation where I'll show you the answer, the most recent one that we've actually gotten to publication state, is this one. So this is work by Dan Grin. He had this elaborate method for following the very high excited levels of hydrogen, which I believe he talked about a few months ago. This is a calculation where he compares basically the convergence of the calculation as a function of the number of shells of the hydrogen atom that you consider. You can see going from eight shells up to 16 and then to 32 and 64 and so on, the errors go down, which is the right direction. The last calculation was 250 shells, and because he follows each value of L, the angular momentum quantum number, there are more than 30,000 levels in that calculation. Which, for our computational capabilities, was a significant challenge. Weili has a better computer than I do, but so where are we now? Well, we have a few more pieces of physics that need to be investigated. What happens when the high-lying Lyman lines, Lyman 40, Lyman 41, start to overlap? You can emit a photon in one line and get absorbed in another. There's Thomson scattering. Photons can get their frequency changed when they scatter off an electron. Not by very much, but if it takes you from the red side of the line to the blue side or vice versa, that's a big deal. So it means you can avoid getting absorbed. We've discussed the use of Fokker-Planck equation to treat the diffusion of photons in these resonance lines. How accurate is that? What about forming hydrogen molecules? We know at lower redshift, hydrogen molecules actually form lines that are that become close to optically thick. If the if something like that could happen in the early universe, then it could affect some of the calculations I've been talking about. That's a hard question, because it's exponentially sensitive to things that so far we've only calculated at the back of the envelope level. I think we can complete all of that by the end of 2010, at which point the final step will be to release a publicly available code that can do all of this. Then once again, Little and Light's statement that you can use these things as a black box will be accurate as long as you trust us. It needs to be fast, because modern CMB data analysis works by doing these Markov chains that explore with millions of models consistent with the data. So we need to get our computation time down from days to minutes or even seconds. That sounded hard, especially given the number of levels, and we'd been talking about fitting formulas. But a few weeks ago, Yassine, our fourth-year graduate student, walked into my office with a way of manipulating the matrix describing the high levels of hydrogen that basically enables you to, decompose the matrix into parts that depend only on atomic physics and parts that depend only on cosmology. So I think there are at least a few orders of magnitude speed up from his idea. That should be useful. He's working on coding it up and testing it now. We promised the answer to the NSF by September 2011, and we will make the deadline one way or another. I'm not sure if I'll get another grant if we don't. So that's it for the theory. And I just wanted in my last 2 or 3 minutes to talk about testing it. How do we know that we did this giant calculation right? Yes.
That since the early parts of recombination were the parts that were speeded up and the later parts were slowed down, that the high L temperature went down. What was the intuition for why the low L polarization went up?
So what you've done is, because you've increased the number of free electrons at late times, you've produced an additional scattering source. It's just like reionization, except it's happening at redshift 900. So we have this elaborate theory. I'm going to give my colleagues on the Planck satellite a computer program. To calculate all of this stuff, they're going to run it, and they're going to come back and tell us that NS is different from 1. And then the question is, are we going to believe it, or are we going to say we did something, there's something wrong with the recombination calculation? That's going to be a big question. And there are at least 3 ways this could be wrong. In order of likelihood, maybe. I should take off my Bayesian cap here. These are all possibilities, and I'm not going to assign priors to any of this. But could be wrong
because we have a bug. Knowing my programming skills, that's not too unlikely. Caltech undergrads are better. We could also be incorrect because we missed an important piece of atomic physics. Probably the most exciting would be if the recombination history that we calculate turned out to be wrong. Because there's some new decaying particle or a fundamental constant changed, or some reason why conventional physics just doesn't give you the right answer. That would be really interesting. What does one do about this? Well, the bugs issue, what you really want are code comparisons from different groups. And Jens Kluba, who many of you probably know, has his own recombination setup, and he and Dan Grant have been doing a number of code comparisons. So that work is moving along. But you also want to empirically validate the theory. And so there are two ways you might think about doing that. The first would be to actually search for the remnant CMB, or the remnant photons from recombination. I don't think that's likely, at least in the near future. And the reason is that Lyman alpha photons then are in the far infrared now. And there are a few of these recombination photons for every baryon. And if you compare that to the other stuff that produces far infrared radiation, which is dust, you can compute the amount of far infrared radiation from dust using Drake equation, which tells you that the number of far infrared photons per baryon is equal to the maximum number you can produce if you fused all baryons and turned that energy into infrared, is a few MeV, the energy yield for fusion, over 0.01 eV, the energy of an infrared photon. And then you can multiply by factors like the fraction of the baryons you turn into stars, the fraction of the hydrogen stars that you fuse, the fraction of that energy that gets reprocessed by dust. But these are all, a few tenths, and this is huge. This is 10 to the 8. So I think, at least in the short term, we're not going to see this. Maybe in the far future we will. I think the better opportunity is the microwave background polarization, in particular that the ratio of polarization to temperature and isotropies is increased by the effects I was talking about, precisely because you produce some additional ionization at late times. And as you can see here, this works on scales of half a degree up to maybe a degree. Unfortunately, the sensitivity to do that at the precision level may be a little bit beyond Planck satellite, so we need another satellite. That will be a while. What?
Can't be done from the ground.
To do a polarization to 1%.
Well, I guess much better than 1%.
Yeah, if you want to do that, you need to cover essentially the whole sky to convincingly do this above cosmic variance.
Why is there a big cosmic variance? I mean, you've got a signal out to 2000 L and 2000, right?
This part.
Yeah.
This is the part that has the same tail as the temperature. So if you said I want to measure this effect, I could pull it out these multiple poles here by reducing NS, and then I do the same thing for temperature, and then I catch all the difference.
So the real signature is where?
The signature is here because the polarization went up and the temperature went down at the same scale. And no twisting around the primordial power spectrum can do that. You might be able to do that with judicious calculations of correlating noise and curvature modes. But as far as things that we think of as standard cosmological parameters, you would not do that. But I haven't explored the full isocurvature parameter space.
Very wise.
I hope I've convinced you that understanding the recombination epoch is critical if we're going to do high precision fundamental physics with CMB, in particular with the Planck satellite. That recombination is a subject where it's far from dead. In the past few years, we've made a number of revisions to the theory that are comparable to or greater than the precision expected from the next generation of experiments. And finally, I think the microwave background polarization is the best way to tell whether we did this all right. I think a basic test of the recombination history whether it was actually delayed the way we think it was relative to what the Saha equation would predict. Is there something grossly wrong? We could answer that with Planck. If we're going to start going after these sub-percent effects, then I think directly testing this probably requires the next satellite. But some progress can be made now. Thank you.
So in terms of the most, what you said was the most exciting way that the calculation could be wrong, that reminds me that, so I don't know what the current status of this is, but those the claims that the fine structure constant appeared to be changing by comparing, laboratory spectra to higher redshift spectra, would those be, if alpha was really changed by that amount, would it have comparably large, don't they claim changes in alpha?
You would have to imagine something that changed rapidly very early in the universe and then slowed down.
Yeah. So
maybe there's a controlling scalar whose kinetic energy redshifted away.
So, but roughly speaking, alpha would have to be different by a percent from its current value to be produced percentage x.
I haven't changed alpha in my code. It's always been 1/137. But this is seven sigma. So I think something more than -3, sort of the minimum that would have to affect.
I have a recollection of 21 centimeters. One formula where alpha is like 11 powers. It allows self increase there.
What about short wavelength inhomogeneities in the universe that emerged? It came into this epoch of recombination with a significant background of sound waves on short wavelengths. Would they?
Could they
change things without impacting anything else?
You could imagine two things happening. You've got these standing acoustic waves, and there's a velocity field associated with them. And if you talk about velocity fields and Lyman alpha to an astronomer, they tell you, "Wow, that's going to be a big deal."
Mm-hmm.
Because you resonantly scattering and compression the velocity, redshifts or blue shifts the photons.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that if you think about the scale over which those sound waves are not damped, essentially the Silk scale at whatever redshift, photons that redshift through the Lyman alpha line move some tiny, tiny fraction of that distance, just because the mean free path is so short. It's in a resonance line of the most abundant element of the universe. The answer is that photon would just see locally a slight change in the Hubble expansion grade and maybe some shear. And because the convergence perturbation, delta H over H, are most order 10 to the -4, I don't think you'll see anything there. Then you could ask, the small scale sound waves have damped and they've raised the temperature by damping, but the amount of energy contained in those compared to the thermal energy is tiny. So I don't think conventional cosmology, standard basic lamp CGM contains any such effect. But certainly, given how little information we have on very small scale perturbations, if you had a cosmological model that produced much more short wavelength power, for example, there may well be something you could do with that.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of a first order phase transition or something that didn't happen. Well, that happened reasonably late.
Well, one way of getting that is to have inhomogeneous baryogenesis,
yeah.
In which case you get all the unity inhomogeneous nucleosynthesis to modulate these things by a percent or something. I mean, it's not huge, but it would have not small.
Yeah, okay, so take that as an example. Say that the
Baryon
asymmetry was, well, the I guess there are many ways to do it, but let's say that the nuclear synthesis was very, was clumpy.
Yeah, that...
That would change your...
Yeah, that could be very interesting because you know your output after for the line and off the line will be much will be lower in the regions of low density, for example, and so you might expect faster recombination there. On the other hand, it's harder for the protons and electrons to find each other, and then because these photons here. Are capable of moving from one part of the universe to another. They have a long mean free path. Depending on the spatial scale of these homogeneities, you might imagine that there's actually a radiative transfer crosstalk effect. And I have very little intuition for what that would do.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be an interesting calculation.
What's the current? I've forgotten what the situation is. There was a lot of interest in homogeneous nuclear synthesis quite a long time ago.
Well, that's because another textbook standard introduction from when I was a student is that DBN has proven that nuclear synthesis is homogeneous, but all the proofs have meanwhile been disproven by CMB.
Right.
That they got the wrong lithium, that the lithium dip was wrong. So now you're not constrained on anything. So basically, I think it's taken a step backwards. There's no constraint anymore.
Right. So probably the best constraint would come from this kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm sure probably the best you're going to get to.
That's
right. This is the only way you're going to get it, which is like, you know.
Yeah. Right. The constraint of coincidence and the fact that nothing turned out to be in the working.
That they saw from the dip, and then if you mix things above the dip, you increase your lithium. Mm-hmm. But if not in the dip, you don't get much training. Of course, we know we're at the dip anymore, so that's...
There's another way to probe all this, which would be to do the unequal time correlations of the CMB photon, the CMB radiation,
which is
very futuristic, but not completely impossible.
Measure the impact. The impacts of coherence are different frequencies.
Absolutely.
You're different unequal space time
coordinates. So maybe in 50 years, we'll...
How much time are you elapsed? Are you talking
about? Well, it's the reg. It's basically the CMB frequency redshift to today. So it's gigahertz frequencies. But you'd have to measure the unequal time correlations of like radiation field coming to you from the early universe. But that will tell you all about the scattering history. And recombination and all that. I mean, it's a whole different calculation, but it's like you've done, except at unequal times. And
I haven't looked at that, but if you wait long enough for a high enough sensitivity on dumped T over T, then you could measure that. Yes.
You had something of maybe the Fokker-Planck equation is wrong. What was that exactly?
So I told you that in this plot here, or I'll show you the equation, this guy, that in this process, the line at all the photon gets a small change in its frequency, it's all higher kinetic moving. And because that change is small, we treat it with the Fokker-Planck equation.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that when you go up to the higher order Lyman lines, where the damping wings are optically thin, then a single one of these scatterings actually moves you by something of order of alignment. And then you say, well, maybe it's not well described by the Fokker-Planck equation anymore. And so Yassine actually looked at that. And the answer, I was initially very excited about it. Unfortunately, the answer is it does not lead to a detectable effect. But it was, you know, it was one of those concerns, and you know, the nature of the subject is that, you know, pretty much any conventional effect, you're going to have to either calculate or at least come up with some upper bound on its magnitude. You know, if you're going to seriously trust the final result.
Could you just explain briefly why it's so hard to calculate the production of molecules?
Yes. So, the way you would normally produce hydrogen molecules in a molecular cloud, for example, is on the surface of dust grains. You find hydrogen atoms, and they tunnel from one side to another until they find each other. In the early universe, we don't have dust. You then might imagine you stack two hydrogen atoms together, and they make an H2 molecule, but there's no dipole moment. You then might imagine I can catalyze hydrogen molecule formation with the free electrons. And that's right. And in proto-galaxies, that may be the major source of H2. This has a dipole moment if the electron comes in the P wave. The problem is this has a binding energy 3/4 of AeV. So you get that as well. So that's no good.
It just doesn't live long enough to get the second H. Or?
Yeah, you've got so many more CMB photons than hydrogen atoms that this happens almost all the time. So you need something more tightly bound than H minus. That more tightly bound than H minus could be this. This has a binding energy of 2.6 eV instead of 0.75. So it's exponentially more likely to hold itself together in the early universe. And at one time it was believed that this was actually the major source of H2. The problem with this is that this ion has 420, I think, rotation vibration levels, and the transitions between them are forbidden because there's no dipole moment. And it turns out that this reaction preferentially populates only the very weakly bound states. The reason being that this, if you look at this molecule, the electron can occupy either the symmetric or anti-symmetric orbital around the two protons. And if you draw the potential as a function of separation, the anti-symmetric state is repulsive. The symmetric state is attractive. The only allowed dipole transitions are between anti-symmetric and symmetric. You can't go symmetric to symmetric or anti-symmetric to anti-symmetric. So the only, because this is repulsive, and this is where the bound states are, the production mechanism is that you go from an unbound repulsive state to a bound attractive state, and then to overlap the wave functions, right? In order to have overlap of these wave functions, you have to have the least bound state, or the least bound few states. So this means that even though this has highly bound states, there's no way to make them. Or at least they're exponentially suppressed by this essentially tunneling problem. So what we believe the principal mechanism to produce H2 in the early universe would be is inverse Lyman-Broder dissociation. So if you think about the H2 molecule, the H2 molecule, in its ground state, if you talk to an ISN person and you ask what happens to H2 in the interstellar medium, they tell you there's an ultraviolet photon that excites you to an excited state, either they have historical label, either B or C. And then that decays by emission of another UV photon. And because you have these Lyman alpha photons running around the virial universe, it's possible to run all of these reactions in reverse. So then you ask, I give you an non-equilibrium radiation field, which direction wins, how much H2 do you end up with? And it really depends on where the cross sections for these reactions land relative to all the features of the spectrum I showed. And it's something where we just have to do the calculation because there's no way that you can get out of an order of magnitude type of argument.
So at the moment, you don't know the fraction of H2?
We don't. Asandir Elizade has a giant setup to calculate it.
Wow.
But it's there are other complications in the spectra. Nobody has published the data we need. So I asked Asandir to recalculate all of these H2 dissociation coefficients. And so that's almost done.
And the main question is how, when that will affect when the first sort of stars form? Isn't H2 important for cooling?
It is, but for the recombination effort, the question is, you see all the ultraviolet photons that are being created and destroyed moving around. And the question would be, does that remove photons from Lyman alpha? Does it put them back in Lyman alpha? What does it do? Does it move around a number of Lyman rich photons? That's of order 10 to the minus 3 of what there is, or is it 10 to the minus 6, in which case we don't care about it, or is it 0.1, in which case we already have a problem? we don't know. That's why we're calculating it.
Perfect.
Okay, well, if there's no other questions, thanks again to Chris for a great talk.